We need to talk really quickly about stress. ADHD and stress go together like toddlers and public tantrums, completely unavoidable and painfully frequent. If you are constantly replaying what you should have done, could have done, and didn't do, then this guide is for you. I wrote this specifically for ADHD hyperactive mum brains. First up, my personal values clarification exercise. Think of this as your life's GPS, except it won't reroute you back to being the people pleaser that you swore you'd stop being. It is quick, it is simple, it is ready to implement straight away. It isn't a 100-page woo-woo workbook that you'll never open. It is all about finding clarity even when life feels overwhelming and unmanageable. The next part is the essential de-stress planner for hyperactive mums. Forget the color-coded planners, then you completely make a mess of it, or maybe you feel like a failure because you never actually started filling it out because you never had the right pen. These beautiful planners are that. They are beautiful, but certainly aren't hyperactive ADHD mum-proof. My personal values clarification exercise and the essential de-stress planner are 100% fluff-free, made for the ADHD mum life. You can pick these up, put these down, start anytime. This is coffee spill friendly. It won't guilt trip you if you forget that it exists for a week. Use it to brain dump the chaos, prioritize like a boss, and work with your life, not against you. Grab your copy now at adhdmums.com.au, and all of the links will be in the show notes. Now let's jump into today's episode.
Trigger warning on this episode for anybody who would prefer not to listen to content on child sex safety.
Hello and welcome to the next episode of ADHD Mums. Today we have Christy McVie back again. How are you, Christy?
Yeah, I'm great, thank you.
Apologies about my voice. I'm a little bit more husky than normal, but I feel completely fine. But if you're wondering what is going on with Jane, I've just got a touch of the COVID, but I'm all good and I'm powering through. If you would like to know more about who Christy is, you could check her out on the show notes. If you go back to the first episode that we released last week, Christy's got quite a lengthy introduction about who she is, her background, and why she got into this type of work. You can go back to that episode, which is Neurodivergent Children, Social Safety and Grooming with Christy McVie. For everybody who has already listened to that episode, let's jump right into the practical strategies. The last episode we talked about was grooming and the risks for neurodivergent children and what parents should look for as warning signs. Today, we really want to explore the practical, proactive steps to protect our children and how to educate them. I talked last episode about how I have been kind of putting my head in the sand and assuming it happens to other people that I don't know where they live. But definitely me, all the children that I know are completely safe and I don't need to worry about it, which is an absolute myth. But what I would love to do, which I have not done yet, which is hilarious because I'm in the work that I do and all I do is talk about ADHD and neurodivergence, but yet I have not really had those safety discussions. So I'd love to talk to you today, Christy, about how parents can start having those age-appropriate conversations about social safety and grooming, because I think one of the things that stops us is that we don't want to scare our child. What are some ways that we can get started with that?
Yeah. So the first thing that I would do, I mean, I talk a lot about body safety, and the reason why I talk a lot about body safety is because I know that it works. In my experience investigating child sexual abuse and interviewing children, the kids that had protective behaviors is the umbrella term for body safety, but the kids that had body safety education and protective parents or safe parents, even if something happened, they were quicker to come forward to a parent or to a safe adult, and it stopped immediately. And the residual trauma and everything that came with it, it has a huge impact on their lives, right? So they felt safe, so they went to someone listened and it stopped. Whereas the kids who don't have that safety education, that body safety education, and they don't have safe adults or protected parents in their corner, those kids, unfortunately, that went on for years and years and years, or it was worse, or, you know, there was a lot more harm done psychologically, emotionally. And generally, kids do try and tell people in different ways. Sometimes it's not, hey, I'm being sexually abused. And sometimes they don't have the language. And that's what body safety education does. First of all, it gives children a framework to know that what's appropriate and inappropriate, what's safe and unsafe, what's a secret and a surprise, or a safe secret and an unsafe secret. It gives them tools or the railway tracks, for instance, to know what to do if something happens that makes them feel unsafe. So that's why body safety is so important. And the thing is that when I talk to people and they're like, oh, but surely you don't talk to two-year-olds about this. And I'm like, yeah, but we're not saying sexual abuse and we're not saying things. We're saying things like, what does it feel like in your body when you don't feel safe? You know, what is your body telling you? I used to ask that question all the time. What does your body tell you? And if they're given the language, they can very easily articulate that. So little children, we're teaching them their body names of their private parts, the actual names, not fancy names or not friggin' nicknames or any of that, because abusers will use nicknames to trick children into being abused. They also will use games or gamify their abuse so that the child, first of all, doesn't think it's abuse because it's a game that they get a reward for. And second, when they tell parents, oh, I was playing this game with such and such, parents think it's just a game. They don't think it's abuse. So, you know, teaching children the correct terminology is extremely important and should be done from birth. Talking to kids about what's it feel like? What are their early warning signs? Helping them with language around that. You know, when I feel unsafe, I get butterflies in my tummy. You know, they make me feel sick. Sometimes I feel like I've got shaky knees or my hands are sweaty or I get a headache. And allowing children to investigate what it feels like for them and have those words for them. Then we talk about secrets. You know, it's in our family, we don't have secrets, but sometimes we have to have surprises. Surprises are like when we buy dad his surprise birthday present. We don't want him to know until his birthday. So secrets are things that make us feel unsafe. They don't have a timeline, so there's not an end date, and we can't tell our safe people about. Surprises, there is an end date. They're not making us feel unsafe. And we can tell our safe people if we need to, even if it was someone's present or something. So, you know, that's how we differentiate, especially for little kids. But we can evolve that language as they get older, right? And then there's other things like inappropriate versus appropriate. Okay, so we know our body parts for little kids. And then we tell them no one's allowed to touch our body parts, our private parts, which includes the mouth, by the way, for anyone who doesn't know that. The mouth is a private part. And when no one's allowed to put anything in our private parts, no one's allowed to touch our private parts, and we're not allowed to touch others. That's our body safety right. They're like little rules that we teach our kids. For little kids, it's like, hey, we don't touch anyone else's private parts. What are our private parts? And get them to label them and list them. And they're just another part of our body. And you can talk about private clothes versus public clothes. Our private parts could be anything that's covered when we go to the beach. So if we wear bathers, we cover up our boobs and nipples, we cover up our bum and private parts. So that's some language we can use for little kids. When they get to sort of, you know, 4 or 5, 6, we can start saying things like, it's not okay for anyone to touch our private parts. We don't touch anyone else's private parts. And adults versus kids, because there's some behaviors that happen, you know, you show me yours, I'll show you mine. Can I have a look at that? You know, those sorts of things. That's normal development. But at the same time, we want our kids to know that our body safety rights are we don't touch other people's, we don't show other people's, and they don't show theirs to us. And I have a bit of a debate going on my socials about showering and bathing with children and sleeping naked with children, etc. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. It's not the bathing or sleeping together with children. It's the fact that our child should never be forced to do anything that they don't want to do. If a child says no to bathing with you, don't make them bathe with you. They have to have body autonomy. And so teaching children about bodily autonomy, that it's their body, they get to choose what happens to it. When it comes into a bit of like there's some, you know, gray area is when, say, for instance, a toddler doesn't want to have their nappy changed, but they're desperate for a nappy change. Hey, buddy. I know you don't want your nappy changed. I'm going to give you 5 more minutes, but after 5 minutes, we're going to have to change your nappy because it really, really smells or it's really wet and you're going to get a rash. That's a choice, but you're giving them a choice. You want to do it right now or do you want to do it in 5 minutes? You're explaining the consequence, like we're going to do it. We have to do it. There are also things like, you know, crossing the road. Like some kids don't want to hold hands. Hey, buddy, we have to hold hands whilst we cross the road. It's because it keeps you safe and me safe, you know. And when they do say no, hey, that's really awesome that you know that you can say no. But in this case, we really need to do this. So let's work together. We're a team. I hope that sort of gives you some understanding of like we can start from littlies and we can work our way up. When I started talking about, you know, the real issues of child sexual abuse was around 8 years old because my daughter came home from school and a student at school had told her what sex was. I was like, what? I was not ready. And I was a detective investigating this stuff, right? But she was 8 and she comes home and she kept saying, I never want to have SEX. SEX is gross. And I was like, what do you know about SEX? Because we hadn't had that conversation yet. And she said, oh, I don't want to talk about SEX. No, I don't want to talk about it. And she was embarrassed. She didn't want to talk about it, right? So after a few days, sitting next to her in the car on the way to ballet, she said it again. And I said, hey, I have a feeling that someone said something or shown you something at school. And that's okay. You're not in trouble. But would you mind telling me what you know? Because what you might have heard might not be actually correct. And I'd rather you have the right information than the wrong information. And she said, oh, are you sure? And I said, yep, you're not in trouble. I'm not going to get angry. You just need to tell me so I can tell you whether it's right or wrong. And she blurted out, she goes, sex is when a man puts his penis in a woman's vagina and stuff comes out the end of it. Oh, it's so gross. And she was 8. And to, you know, to finish that, she said, oh, it's so gross. I'm going to be a lesbian when I grow up. And I said to her, do you know what a lesbian is? And she goes, no, but it sounds better than that. And I said,
there's still like stuff with being a lesbian. It doesn't mean you don't have sex at all. Oh my God.
I know. And I said, okay, well, we'll tackle that subject next time. and the poor thing, like she blurted it out in like a quick blur. And then she looked at me as I was driving and I'm sitting there. My brain is going, oh, and I hope you don't mind me swearing, but she goes, I've just gone, oh, fuck, in my brain. And my brain was like frozen for a second. And she looks at me with big eyes and she says, is it true? And I had a moment in my brain that went, you have to tell her the truth. Otherwise, she'll never trust you with anything. And so I had this moment of like, I have to tell her. And so I said, yeah, baby, that's true. And that's when she was like, oh, that's disgusting. Why would anyone do that? And she was just so grossed out by it. And I was like, well, this is the thing. And this is how I talked to her. I was like, yeah, it is gross because you're a little person, you're a child, and it's not for children. And when you're older, you know, we'll keep talking about this, but when you're older, you'll understand. I said, but that's why it's not for children. And that's why it's gross, because you'll know more when you're older. And so when we had that conversation, you know, I left it for a couple of days. And this is the thing about repairing and going back to your kids. You can have a really crappy reaction or like an overreaction or like freak out. But here's how I used to go back to my child. I'd go, hey, you know, the other day when we had that conversation about SEX or however, hey, have you got any questions? Like, I realized that we didn't cover it all. Or maybe you've got questions that you thought of since. Is there anything you want to ask me? And, you know, and I usually did it when we were either laying in bed at night, when saying goodnight, reading her a book, or when we're in the car, or just the two of us. And what I found is that she would always have questions, but they weren't as bad as I thought they would be. Like, they were always like, oh, I just, does everyone have sex? And because she felt so safe to ask these questions to me, she went around and asked her grandparents if they had sex still. And she went and asked, you know, all of these people. I was like, yeah, it was hilarious. And, you know, that's neurodivergence for you. They either blurt it all out or they don't say anything. But I just kept encouraging her to come to me when things came up. And again, like I said in the last episode, when she was 10, she saw porn, right? And she didn't feel safe and she felt scared. She felt sick. So how that happened was she was looking for puberty education because she just had a puberty course in school, right? 10, she was in year 5. And she Googles SEX. And of course, what comes up? It's porn, porn, porn. And we had had these conversations and we had talked about it. I had talked about not necessarily porn, but I had talked about inappropriate content and what that looked like. And I had explained that, you know, inappropriate content is adults with no clothes on, adults looking like they're wrestling, like they might be fighting. You know, if you see anything, if they're showing you their private parts, that's inappropriate content. And when you see that, you should come and tell me. And so all of these things are like, this is how we can have these conversations without having the conversation. But we have to be willing to have the conversation first, the body safety conversations at the start. And it's a scaffolding thing. It's like we have those like really innocent conversations at the start, then we add on and we add on and we add on. And I had a parent ask me a couple of, maybe during the year, their 9-year-old came home and said, what is rape? And trying to explain 9-year-old to a rape who doesn't know what inappropriate touching or inappropriate behaviors are, you don't just start it, oh, well, rape is this. So, you know, this is why I really, really encourage parents, wherever you're at, whatever age your child is at, have these body safety conversations and start from the beginning, start from like inappropriate, safe, you know, et cetera. and explaining it, because then we can have these conversations and none of it matters. They don't blink an eyelid. They just ask you a question, you answer it, and everyone's happy. You know, there's no uncomfortableness in any of it. And my daughter's 16, 17. She has survived. I've survived. We've survived. So you can do that too.
Wow. I had to write notes because I was, and I've also like got to talk to husband. So, oh my God. Sorry. I went into a bit of a spin. I had to take a moment so I can see a few things I need to address in my life, and inappropriate content online is one of those things. There's some massive gaps in my parenting that I've just become aware of.
It's okay. It's okay.
That's okay. I think I could still get there. So many neurodivergent children and many neurodivergent people take other people on their word. One of the things that neurodivergent people get caught up in particularly is a lot of neurodivergent people have got the best intentions. There's actually really a lack of manipulation, if I can say that. Who they are, a lot of the time, is who they are. That there's a really genuine authenticness to a neurodivergent person, I've noticed, that is just beautiful. But what that can do is, because your intention is good, you assume that other people's intentions are good. And that can be the issue in business transactions, life, work, wherever, but also growing up, being a child, and the assumption that other people's intentions are good. What kind of work can we do with our children around critical thinking and actually looking at a social interaction for what it is, rather than just seeing it as another really positive person because your intentions are positive?
Yeah, my daughter really struggled with this. And I think all people do struggle with like seeing the real people. It's why it's so important. There's a couple of points here. It's right why it's so important for us to teach our kids to listen to their early warning signs, their gut feelings, and to give them the courage to, you know, listen to them and act on them. Because when our children know that if I feel unsafe, I do this, then, you know, in their interactions with other people, they might actually go, oh, actually, I don't want to do that, but I feel like I have to. But mum's taught me I can say no. And this is the thing, like there's five different types of no, and that's a whole nother conversation, right? There's the polite no all the way to the emergency no. You know, teaching our kids how to decline and standing up and being safe, like this is how I feel, I'm not going to. And my daughter really struggles because, like you just pointed out, she struggles with the fact that if she says no, why? I don't want to do that. I'm not doing it. And people don't know how to accept a no. Like, we haven't done a very good job of teaching Australian kids and adults and people how to accept no. And so, you know, empowering our kids to know if you don't want to do something, you don't have to do it. And one of the lessons I taught my daughter, and I'm getting off track, sorry. One of the lessons I taught my daughter was, we're not responsible for other people's feelings. It's really important to know that not everyone's going to like you. You're not going to like everyone else, but all we have to do is be polite. And it's not our responsibility if someone doesn't like how you feel. And it's not your job to make someone feel good. So from around 8, 9, 10, we talked about that stuff. And here's the thing. I've written about it all in my book about respectful and healthy relationships and how we don't teach kids, or we weren't taught, and we haven't taught our children very often, that by teaching them about things like we're not responsible for other people's feelings, it's not our job to make other people happy. When we teach our kids those lessons, and it backfires, by the way, I taught my daughter, I'm not responsible for how you feel and you're not responsible for how I feel. I taught her that around 8, 9, 10. And so when I said something to her when she was about 11 years old and I said, you know, you're making me feel like this, she goes, well, that's your responsibility, not mine. And she still, yeah, and she still teaches that to me today when I say, you know, because we use feeling words. When you do this, I feel like this, or I feel like this when you do that sort of thing. And she burns me all the time. She's like, well, that's your responsibility. If you're upset, that's your problem. It's not mine. I mean, this is the thing. When you teach neurodivergent kids, they are literal, right? But she's my greatest teacher in that she's taught me that. And it's a good lesson to learn. It's a good lesson to teach, because our children are so many times, and I've seen it so many times, sadly, and I'm sticking to the same topic, but neurodivergent people are at much greater risk of domestic violence and abuse because of the same reasons kids are at risk of child abuse. So, you know, if we were taught that we're not responsible for other people's feelings, what safe and healthy love looks like, You know, safe and healthy loves not being told what to do, not what told what to wear, you know, having someone comment on your friends and not keep you from your friends. And I saw those sorts of behaviors happening when my daughter was about 10 with her friendship groups. You know, she had one friend who wanted to control all her time. She had one friend that wanted to, said she couldn't hang out with this person. If she hung out with that person, it made her upset. If she did this or she did that, she had to control everything about my daughter. And we see that in young girls and boys, but more so in young girls, especially around that 9, 10 age, where they're all of a sudden their friends are trying to control what they do. And I would point it out, and I called it coercive control back then, even though that now it's just, it's a term that we use all the time. Hey, that's really coercive control. That is actually like not okay. No one's allowed to tell you that. No one's allowed to teach you that. And I think there was a study, and please don't go after me if you can't find this study. I just can't remember where I saw it, is that neurodivergent girls especially are at more risk of becoming pregnant before 18. Because of the fact there's impulse control and there's all of these things, and they're looking for, like, I'll say love in the wrong places, like wherever we can get it, because we feel like we're missing something, that we're not normal or whatever. And I mean, vulnerable children are the same. But what I would say to that is, as parents, we can pump our kids up and we can give them all those lessons. It might happen, but it might not happen. And my daughter now, like I said, she's been in a relationship for a couple of years now, and sometimes I feel sorry for her boyfriend. But why, I would rather that than the opposite, you know, like she could have got into a relationship and being coerced and bullied and had this person like tell her how to act and, you know, she couldn't hang out with this friend or that friend. I'd rather the fact that she's so strong and determined and knows her rights than the opposite, which is that she becomes a victim of domestic violence and abuse.
I think it's a great point that you've brought up, because we're looking at this in terms of child sex safety and keeping your child safe. But actually, you're talking about healthy boundaries. You're talking about healthy relationships. I did a DV miniseries late last year, which was an interesting experience, because I think someone like yourself, Christy, would have handled it a lot better than what I did, because I didn't really know what I was getting into when I started interviewing. And it was, I found it to be really difficult personally, which I felt really like I didn't have the right to say that, because I was like, these people have actually been through it. I'm listening to it and I'm really affected. It felt like such a wrong thing to say. But what I noticed when I interviewed was that it, not always, but most of the time, it seemed to start quite early. But what you're talking about is identifying healthy behaviours, healthy relationships, healthy body safety, what feels good, what is a positive relationship, and those social skills actually really blend in for the long game in terms of attracting a healthy relationship, maintaining a healthy relationship. And what is that? Because if the child does not know what that is, how will they know what to look for? Or how will they know when they're in an unhealthy relationship? I think it's a great question.
Yeah. And in my experience, talking to parents, talking to kids, and just observing, I think that's what made me be able to write a book and talk about this stuff, is because I used to just pay attention to what I was seeing, and I was drawing lines, and I could see that people who don't have good support networks, or at least one safe person, people who haven't had these lessons and tools built into their childhoods, you know, or they don't have that confidence to say no. In my book, I talk about, you know, consent, right? And I had a grandmother who read my book. She was in her 70s. She had 5 grandchildren. She spent a lot of time with them, and she read my book because she wanted to help them stay safe. And she said to me, I read your book about, and I just needed to tell you that I have never had anyone explain consent to me. And I have many instances of being sexually abused because I didn't know I could say no. And, you know, this is the thing. If we don't teach our kids that it's okay to say no, and again, prefacing that with sometimes they can't say no because it's for their safety and well-being, but for the most part, we can offer it. And this is the other thing, like I talk about this in other podcasts, but I just remember thinking with my own daughter, if I don't give her the power and I don't respect her no and her boundaries, then when she gets to the age of, you know, her first sexual relationship, she will feel like she is pressured or can't say no in that situation, which happened to me. And so I couldn't say no to people because I wasn't told I could say no. So therefore I was saying yes to everything, but deep down inside, I didn't want to do these things. So no parent, and I'm especially parents listening to this, no parent wants their children to do things that they didn't want to do or feel like they can't say no and then you know, the result of that, because it leaves an impact. And even I've seen men who, you know, even in their early years, they were like, oh, I just didn't know how to receive a no. I felt like I had a right to just keep going. And now they're living with the guilt and the shame of the fact that they didn't understand themselves and what that was. And a little bit the same topic but off topic is that our children could be the ones hurting another child or another person if we don't teach them this. And I saw that time and time again, because us as parents need to teach our kids what no is, how to receive a no, what their body safety. And it's not their fault, they're kids, right? But they could be harming another child and we don't even know it. And they don't know it.
True. I mean, it's the same. Your child could actually be a bully at school and you are unaware. So you're relying on other people giving you feedback and then teaching your child the social skills from a young age. Like, this is what a friend is. You doing that is not friendship.
Yeah.
Because if they don't get it explained, a lot of these neurodivergent children don't have natural social skills. They may not know what friendship is. They may think that's controlling someone, like you mentioned earlier. But unless they receive feedback and get that skills upgrade, they have no idea what they're doing.
Yeah, and I will say this, you don't have to do it all through conversations. There's so many books, especially for young kids, that are really helpful in this. They're social stories. They talk about consent. They talk about, you know, being a good friend. They talk about body safety. And I definitely will give you a list of some that I recommend. They're the type of books you throw in between other books, you know, or you leave on the shelf and the kids can look at them when they're going through reading. There's books that you can read them or that you can show them. There's conversations. Like, here's another tip, and this episode's all about tips. So I find with all kids, but especially kids with neurodivergence, using what if questions or what would you do questions. So what could kids do if? So if you want to broach a subject and you're not sure if they're going to like receive it, hey, what could kids do if, or what do your friends do if, you know, like what could kids do if someone came to them in the street and asked them to get in their car? So then you're talking through the action plan. So when I was a police officer, we did scenario training all year round. We trained it on things that never, ever happened for me. I got taught how to deal with an active shooter or a high-risk vehicle stop or whatever, right? So we did all of these scenarios just in case it ever happened. The same thing is for your children. What could kids do if? What would your friend do if? Has any of your friends ever had this happen? So when I wanted to know if what my daughter's friends were doing online and what she might be subject to or what she might be exposed to, be like, have any of your friends ever been on TikTok before it was TikTok? I think it was Musical.ly. Have any of your friends got Musical.ly? Have any of your friends got Snapchat? You know, and she was only 9 or 10 years old, but she was able to straight out go, yeah, such and such and such and such. I knew that she was aware of it and what was going on. Then I could evolve the questioning to, oh, have you ever had a look at it? Oh, do you know what they do on there? You know, and the other thing, this sneaky side door conversation here is using friends and other children means that then it's not about them. It's about what their friendship groups are doing. And if they're worried about the reaction of you, they're going to be more likely to talk about other people. And so, yeah, that's my biggest takeaway from like parenting and from being a specialist child interviewer is that when kids aren't ready to tell you, they'll talk about their friends before they'll talk about themselves. But when you react to that, if you react really well and calm and you're like, oh, wow. And then you ask follow-up questions like, oh, do you know if they've ever gotten trouble on there? Like, has anyone shared any like inappropriate pictures or asked them for inappropriate pictures or pictures of their private parts? And again, I was having these conversations with my daughter around 8, 9, 10 years old. Then I was able to like, hey, what would you do if someone asked you for a private picture? What would you do if someone did this? So go the side door, ask about friends and other kids, and then you can evolve those questionings.
That is a good tip. I really like that one. Now we are going to finish on one last question, Christy. I did have written down to go into the whole digital world, but what I think we will do is we'll leave that episode. We'll see how these two go. If anyone would like Christy to talk about digital for 30 to 40 minutes, because that's a whole nother world, let me know, send me an email, write on Instagram, follow Christy, ask her to come back. If we get enough people that say that they want to do the digital safety, I'll ask Christy very nicely. But for now, we will leave that. What I would love to do is ask one last question, and that one is, how can parents help their child identify a tricky person versus a safe adult or peer?
Yeah, so I guess it's going back into that, and I keep going back to it, but early warning signs and safe people. So safe people don't make a child feel unsafe. Safe people listen to a child's no. So you can inadvertently teach about tricky people by teaching about what safe is. So, for instance, a safe person always respects a child's no. And in one of the cases that I talked to my daughter about, it was like her grandfather kept tickling her when she said, no, stop it, I don't like it, or whatever. And so I would talk to her about, hey, and first of all, I would stop the behavior. I'd be like, hey, she said no, stop it, no more. And then secondly, I would then have a conversation with her going, you know, it's not okay if someone keeps doing something when you say stop or no. And so then you can evolve that into tricky people. Tricky people will ask you to do things that without your parents around. Tricky people will make you feel unsafe, or tricky people will try and trick you into doing things. And there's a really good book actually for littlies, but you can evolve that again. It's called Tricky I Spy. It's by Kate and Rod Power. It's by some detectives, and they talk about Tricky I Spy, and it's like a rhyming book for littlies. And it's about, you know, how to pick out tricky people. And tricky people can be both adults and kids. And they try to trick you into doing things that, you know, your parents wouldn't like you to do, or that is unsafe and makes you feel unsafe. So going back to that body safety conversation, what safe adults are, and I've got a blog on that if anyone wants to look at that. And then, you know, evolving and talking about age appropriately. Hey, tricky people can be people we know and people we don't know. Because the other thing is when we think stranger, there's some safe strangers out there. Say, for instance, that our children are walking home and they don't feel safe, or someone approaches them, we want them to go to a stranger. We want them to go and knock on a door, or, you know, speak to a mum with a pram over there and say, hey, there's someone following me, or there's someone who's, you know. So we need to teach them about tricky people versus stranger danger, and we need to talk to them about what tricky people might do. They'll trick us into going with them. They won't ask our parents before they ask us to do something, like, hey, can you come and help me find my dog? You know, or mum and dad have told me that mum's in hospital and dad's told me to come and get you. I'm a friend of your dad's. Well, that's a trick that tricky people use. But what we would say is, okay, let's have a safe word for that. And, you know, mum and dad would never trust anyone that didn't know you first to come and get you. So, you know, like, their conversations when your kids might start walking to school, or conversations when your kids are going to the park on their own, you know, you have to have those conversations. You have to prepare your kids, because the world isn't as safe as we want it to be, but it's also not as unsafe as we think. So we just give them a lot of little lessons, and it's not one and done conversations. These are conversations we're going to have for the rest of their childhoods.
Wow. Well, what I'm hearing from you is avoiding is not going to solve it at all. So I've written so many notes. That was so helpful, Christy. Thank you so much for your time. What I would love to know is if anybody would like to read your book. I know you have Conversations with Kids cards on your website. Yep. What would be some relevant products or books or something that you would like to talk about that relate to this conversation that people might want to follow up with?
Yeah, so I'll give you a list of like books that people can grab, like on Amazon and stuff like that. But obviously now you're aware, like, you know that this is happening, you know the statistics. So awareness is the first part to this. You know, body safety conversations. Yeah, I've got the Conversations with Kids body safety cards. They're literally an $11 downloadable product for kids aged 1 to 12 at the moment. And for any parents, we'll probably have a conversation about online safety as well. I've got an online safety guide with the same premise of talking about, you know, with conversation starters of how to have these conversations and what language to use age appropriately. Books are a great one. Having the conversations are a great one. But I guess for most parents, the reason why we don't have these conversations is because we don't know what to say, or we don't want to scare them. So yeah, finding ways to learn that stuff. You know, I've got Operation Kid Safe, my book. That one is really in depth. So all of that stuff that we've talked about is in depth, and it gives you age-appropriate conversation starters and guides in that. So yeah, there's lots of little things. There's also, funny enough, Kmart and Target seem to have some really good body safety books and body safety tools in there as well. So keep an eye out for those. Anything that, when you've got kids that are still in that learning, developing age, you know, they might get to about 9 and they don't want you to talk about some stuff anymore, but we keep talking about it. We keep having these conversations, but you can get like cards about emotions and helping them understand their emotions, especially when children struggle to recognize them, you know, like finding ways to help them, you know, identify. And believe me, they learn by osmosis sometimes. Sometimes they seem like they're not interested, but they remember when we talk about it and when we have these conversations. So just, yeah,
Well, thank you so much for your time. You've been so generous, Christy. I really, really want to thank you. We will release this episode after the last. If you'd like to know more about Christy, I'm going to have everything in the show notes. If you would like to listen to the first episode, I'm going to put that in the show notes. And thank you so much for your time, Christy.
You're welcome.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.